Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 27, 2016. South Sudan's government approves salary increases for civil servants, but some government employees say it's not enough.
So if one sack costs 1,500, what is the balance remaining there? Then you buy a sack of beans, 700. Other basic need will fill up our life, school. So it will not make difference.
And Riek Machar says President Kiir's 28 states is blocking the road to peace. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government says it will increase the salaries of junior civil servants by 300% to be in line with the recent devaluation of South Sudan's pound and the high cost of living. The new salary structure was approved yesterday during an extraordinary Council of Ministers meeting in the capital. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Following a lengthy cabinet meeting chaired by President Salva Kiir, government spokesman Michael McWay told reporters that the restructuring of civil servants' salary will be carried out in three phases.
It is decided that the first phase, that is phase one, should cover the unclassified staff and the junior officials, private and NCOs, and some few officers in the regular forces. These are the people with low income, and that this increment should be by 300%. That is basic pay times three.
McWay says phase two will include civil servants from grade 9 to grade 5, and phase three will include civil servants from grade 4 and above, such as managers and ministers. Phase one goes into effect next month. McWay says phases two and three will be carried out later. He says the government has not specified how much the salaries of civil servants in those categories will be increased.
As you know very well, we have financial problems, so it is decided that the most affected class, which are the unclassified and the other junior staff, these are the people who would immediately benefit from this because they are the most affected. Others, the middle class and the upper class, will follow at another phase.
Garang Ayi is a civil servant who does not want the institution he works for identified because he fears the government might punish him for his comments. He says he makes 1,000 South Sudanese pounds a month. Ayi says increasing that amount by 300% will not have a meaningful impact on his family's living conditions. He says if he starts making 3,000 pounds in February, it won't be enough to feed his family. He says a 50-kilogram sack of white flour costs up to 50% of that money.
So if one sack costs 1,500, what is the balance remaining there? It will be 1,500. Then you buy a sack of beans, 700. Other basic need will fill up our life. School, medical services, transport, renting. So it will not make difference.
Peter Deng, a primary school teacher in Juba, agrees that increasing the wages 300% amid such high inflation does not help. He says traders have more than tripled the cost of many basic food items. He says the government needs a long-term strategy to address the worsening economic situation.
The Minister of Commerce and Supply should supply in products from outside at the government organ. And also the government should monitor to make sure that these prices are kept to a certain price that can benefit all the citizens in the country.
James Alich is an economist at the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies. He says the government should have approved a raise for civil servants across the board instead of breaking it down into three categories.
If they had done them all at one, you would have seen the impact at one. Not a negative one, it could have been a positive one. But I understand why they did what they have done. It's maybe because they don't have enough resources.
Alich says the government should have increased salaries and carried out other measures early on to protect the people from the harsh impact of the high inflation rate before it devalued the local currency in mid-December.
From the very beginning, we were saying, don't put the cart before the horses, meaning they were supposed to be prerequisite, preconditioned, things that should have been done before the realignment.
Alich says other long-term economic policies should be adopted along with the new salary structure in order to ensure that the current inflation is reduced or at least kept in check. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Philip Tonaleu contributed to this story from Juba. The leader of SPLM in opposition, Riek Machar, says he discussed with the Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni the obstacles hindering the implementation of the peace deal signed 5 months ago. Machar says President Salva Kiir's decision to expand the country from 10 to 28 states is one of the obstacles. Philip Thornaleu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Uganda sends its military to South Sudan at the onset of the conflict to support government troops against the SPLM in opposition. Machar says the meeting held on Monday night in Uganda closed that chapter of enmity between Uganda and the SPLM-IO. Machar says they talk about how to overcome obstacles to implementing the peace deal, including the issue of 28 states. Machar says he asked President Museveni to persuade President Kiir to revoke his unilateral decision to create 28 states as opposed to the original 10 on which the August peace agreement was based. Uganda supported the Kiir administrations in its battle against SPLM-IO forces shortly after the conflict broke out in late 2013. The Uganda People Defense Forces has since withdrawn from South Sudan. Machar says the Ugandan president could still use his influence to ensure that the parties implement the peace deal. Speaking to reporters in Kampala on Tuesday, Machar says he will not attend Juba until a new constitution, which includes the provisions of the peace agreement, is adopted by parliament and signed into law. Government spokesman Michael Makwe says Machar's statement means formation of the transitional government of national unity could be delayed by at least a month.
The constitution has not yet gone to the Minister of Justice, and from the Minister of Justice it will come to the cabinet. From the cabinet it will go to the parliament. After the parliament will take its 1 month, and thereafter, if it is passed it and it is sent to the president for assent and signature. This is a process. So maybe up to mid-March, this is the time when the transitional government of national unity will be established.
Makwe says the National Constitutional Amendment Committee, which is comprised of members from both sides, is still working on incorporating terms of the peace deal into the 2011 transitional constitution of South Sudan. He says disagreements remain between the government and the SPLM-IO, particularly over the question of 28 states and presidential advisers. Makwe declined to comment on this week's meeting between Machar and President Museveni. Machar says the meeting turned a new chapter in relations between the Ugandan government and South Sudan's armed opposition and will add new energy to the peace process, but did not elaborate. For VOA News, I am Philip Donaleu in Juba.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan is expressing concern about what it says is an increase in intercommunal violence in some parts of South Sudan. The UNMISS Director of Civil Affairs says while focus remains on the conflict between the government and the armed opposition, hundreds of people have continued to die in intercommunal fighting. Mungume Devs Rwakarinj has this report for VOA from Juba.
UNMISS Civil Affairs Director Ali Hassan says over the last 2 years, more people have died in intercommunal violence than during active combat between government and opposition forces. Hassan says since June, hundreds of people have died in intercommunal attacks and revenge attacks in the former Lake States alone.
There were over 500 people, mostly civilians, but also from the two groups that were fighting, different groups that have been killed. So 500 is a big number, and we haven't seen that number being killed in the actual conflict between two fights, in one or two fights.
Hassan attributed the spike in intercommunal violence to a lack of security agents in areas where tensions are high between different tribal communities.
There is no enforcement from the side of the local authorities, and once these implementation fails and the aggrieved communities see that whatever has been agreed has not been implemented, then they go on the revenge attack.
He says South Sudan's conflict has created mistrust and has undermined community relations between communities. Hassan says UNMISS has been engaging several communities in dialogue to try to prevent or stop intercommunal violence.
It is still continuing as we speak. 2 weeks ago, we have, in a matter of 1 week, where 30 people were killed. And there is no determination of who this person is. Just because somebody is killed, somebody takes revenge and kills a woman and a child.
Hassan says his department has also seen an uptick in violence between cattle keepers and farmers over grazing rights.
There has been a big herd of livestock moving from conflict areas in lakes and in jungle that has moved to other parts of the former Greater Equatoria, and that has generated become sources of conflict because the host communities felt that the migrating communities have taken big piece of their land, they have destroyed their crops, and they want these cattle to go back.
Hassan says he believes the only way to end such a violence is by fully implementing the peace agreement so that government institutions are able to work effectively again. For VOA News, I am Mugume Devs Rwakarinj in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new report says rape is being used as a weapon of war in Sudan. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you love most about where you grew up?
I love the culture and the environment. They taught me a lot of things which I still think and feel they are so useful where I am. I grew up in the village and I got to learn about my culture.
We had an extended family, especially in the holidays. We could have many kids around, we could pray, we could have fun, we could do everything together.
It was peaceful and loving. I just can't trade that for anything.
What I love most about Kampala, just exposure. I've learned many things. It being a capital city, a city center, we meet very many people.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A religious leader says nearly 4,000 people, particularly women and children from the newly created Budue state, have been displaced from their homes due to recent fighting between government forces and a local militia in Yambio. The IDPs are now sheltering in an NGO compound. Gift Friday reports for VOA from Juba.
Nathan Batuel, a pastor in charge of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Budue state, says thousands of people have been affected by the fighting between the Ero Boys and the South Sudan Army. Last Thursday, when the fighting broke out, Batwell says up to 9,000 people sought shelter at the other compound. He says some of these people have since left the area. Batwell, who visited the camp on Tuesday, says the IDPs need food, shelter and medical care.
These children are sleeping on the ground. No mosquito net, no food, nothing being offered to them. And at the moment we are talking, very few organizations that has responded. UNICEF are providing now about almost 10 temporary toilets and dispersing shelters. And then CNMP has, together with the MSF, responded with the medicine for the small children. UNICEF are providing the security at the gate and around.
He says church leaders are trying to find out what caused the latest round of fighting at a time when the local militia and government officials were expected to sign a peace deal.
We did not establish the course route of what happened. So we are also in dilemma. We can't talk about it until we know exactly what happened, which caused the failure of this peace agreement.
IDP Mariam Joseph says she and her 8 children were displaced from the Naduru area. Mariam says women and children are tired of running.
I want to know what the cause of our suffering is. Is it because of the 28 states or 10 states? And I don't know what to think about the results of our suffering. Shall we only die from running, coldness, and sickness like that?
Mariam says for the last 5 days, since she fled to the NGO compound, her children have lived on only porridge. She says a cup of maize flour now cost up to 15 South Sudanese pounds, something she says she cannot afford. Another IDP, Esther Justin, says she was also displaced from the Naduru residential area since Thursday. She says her children are in their need of help.
The children are suffering because of coldness, because the weather is not good, but we are sitting under trees only. We need only help from the government because to provide us food and the medicine.
IDP Joyce Justin agrees.
For the last 5 days, we have had no food. The weather is not good. Children have malaria, diarrhea, and are vomiting. They have helped us with a pit latrine, but other things are not available.
She says she will stay at the other compound until there is total peace in the state. The South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission coordinator in Budwe State, Joseph Salvatore Nzako, says his organization has received a report that 7,000 people are sheltering at the Adra compound in Yambio. He says his commission can only help IDPs who are either in a camp or in the open.
The policy of the government here is that if people are out, then shelter can be given to them. But the when they are in such kind of place, not wise to give them shelter or anything. They have to live with host community.
He says the state is not in position to support anyone staying in an NGO compound.
Let them get out of the compound, we shall care for them. Because we know what they are doing. And also it is very risky for them to be there in that compound. 7,000 people to be in a very confined place like that, security-wise it's not wise.
Speaking on the UN-owned Radio Miraya on Tuesday, Budwe State Governor Raphael Zomoi said calm has returned to the state capital, Yambio. Governor Zomoi says the state government is still investigating the root cause of the recent clashes between the Aero Boys and the SPLM. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Juba.
Human Rights Watch released its 2016 global report today, reviewing human rights practices in more than 90 countries from the end of 2014 through November 2015. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has the details.
During the Nairobi launch of the 2016 Human Rights Watch Global Report, HRW Africa Director Daniel Bekele said poverty, unemployment, massive population growth, bad governance, and weak institutions continue to set the stage for widespread human rights abuses. But the politics of fear is the topic of this year's report, and Bekele highlighted the increasing number of small to large-scale armored violent conflicts in the region. Bekele said extremists, including fundamentalist groups Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and Al-Qaeda, are responsible for much of the violence, committing senseless killings, horrible abuses, and atrocities.
What is an equally worrying trend is how much the security forces' response to the security threat is increasingly downplaying and in some cases probably totally abandoning human rights. And how much security forces' response that is riddled with abuses is actually, you know, sort of contributing to a cycle of abuses.
Arguing that this tenuous security situation may be tied to the intensification of political repression in a number of African countries, Bekele said some governments are adopting what he called a do-whatever-it-takes mentality in restricting freedom of expression and association.
We have seen a spike on attack on journalists, human rights defenders, and political opponents, and overall, you know, sort of like a very heavy crackdown on protests as well.
Bekele also highlighted the concern that Western countries and authoritarian regimes seem to be forming alliances in the face of these security threats.
And Western countries that have traditionally been strong on promoting, protecting, and defending human rights have shown alliance with authoritarian regimes in clamping down on civil and political space.
HRW's Somalia researcher Letitia Bader said that Somalia developed some key policies in 2015 pertaining to sexual and gender-based violence and the country's widespread internally displaced population, but that those policies have not been implemented, and therefore there have been no real changes on the ground. She also mentioned an uptick in fighting in the country due to the ongoing military operation against Al-Shabaab, but also in the drive to establish federal states in Somalia.
So who is able to get a seat at the negotiating table in Somalia in the creation of federalism has often been at a significant consequence to civilians on the ground.
Otsieno Namwaya, HRW's Kenya researcher, highlighted an increase in Al-Shabaab attacks in Kenya, primarily on unarmed civilians.
However, what has really worried us is the response of the Kenyan authorities to the attacks by the Al-Shabaab. The KDF, the Kenya police, that's the regular police, and the anti-terror police, and the GSU, a combination of all these units, have been implicated in a wide range of abuses at the coast in northeastern Kenya and in Nairobi.
But in spite of these negative findings, HRW did cite some improvements on the continent, such as peaceful elections in Nigeria and Botswana, progress in the expansion of economies and socioeconomic services in some African countries, and an increased awareness of maternal mortality and child marriage as rights issues. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Sudan's Darfur region, the Human Rights Watch report reveals that the pattern, scale, and frequency of rape suggests that the government's security forces are using sexual violence as a weapon of war. Human Rights Watch says committing rape and other acts of sexual violence is nothing new in Darfur, but the practice has risen in the past 18 months. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
Mukesh Kapila, the former UN coordinator for Sudan, says years of impunity has allowed criminals, including government security forces, to repeatedly inflict violence on innocent civilians.
This must be surely the worst kept secret in the world. Rape has been used as a weapon of the genocidal war in Darfur ever since the earliest days in 2003. And in the decade since then, this particular technique for terrorizing the local population has got more and more sophisticated, widespread, and systematic.
Kapila says mass rapes have been documented in Darfur for years, and international actors have largely been ineffective in stopping violent sexual crimes.
It's not that the international community is not present there. $1 billion a year are spent on peacekeeping. But, I'm lost for words in relation to why the UN Security Council, the powerful member states, including the United States, which has done so much for Sudan otherwise, refuses to actually go towards the next stage, which is to support the International Criminal Court better and to ensure accountability for these ongoing crimes.
The Sudanese government has pressured the joint UN-AU peacekeeping mission to reduce troop levels in the last couple of years. The New York-based Human Rights Watch also reports that the government shut down the UN-AU mission in Darfur liaison office in Khartoum in late 2014, expelled the UN staff, and denied the renewal of visas for its staff there. Kapila says what needs to happen is the regime needs to be subjected to greater economic, political, and trading pressure. He says although the ICC is not able to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, there are still options available to the African Union and the Security Council to protect civilians and hold people accountable.
Instead, what is happening is more and more countries are establishing stronger economic relations with Sudan. There is oil, and even the United States is reducing its sanctions, and Europe has been trading with Sudan for a long time.
A UN statement released today says recent fighting in Darfur's Jebel Mara has forced about 19,000 civilians to flee into North Darfur State and up to 15,000 into Central Darfur State. Kapila says this is only the latest in a decade-long trend of violence in Darfur.
Fighting has gone up and down over many, many years, and Jebel Mara has always been a pocket of resistance. So there will be fighting in Jebel Mara, there will be fighting in Darfur, and it will continue until we have justice in Darfur, until there is accountability in terms of holding to account the leaders of the government in Sudan, which is actually perpetrating all this.
Almost 11 years have passed since the UN Security Council referred the situation in Darfur to the International Criminal Court. Since then, the ICC has issued arrest warrants for five key individuals, including President Omar al-Bashir, for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in connection with atrocities committed in Darfur. Although the UN Security Council has acted, the ICC has not executed arrest warrants for those crimes. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. The South Sudan government says it will increase the salaries of junior civil servants by 300% to be in line with the recent devaluation of the South Sudanese pound and the high cost of living. The new salary structure was approved yesterday. Government spokesman Michael McQuay says the restructuring of civil servants' salaries will be carried out in three phases. The UN mission in South Sudan is concerned about what it says is an increase in intercommunal violence. The UNMISS director of civil affairs says while focus remains on the conflict between the government and the armed opposition, hundreds of people have continued to die in intercommunal fighting. And finally, a religious leader says nearly 4,000 people, particularly women and children, from the newly created Budwe state have been displaced from their homes due to recent fighting between government forces and a local militia in the state capital of Yombio. The IDPs are now sheltering in an NGO compound. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our story. That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Nani Ongere by Colonel Mido.
Nani Ongere.
We have been listening to Colonel Mido with the song Nani Ongere. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Please tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nani olo tir, nani olo ngere, nani olo tir, nani olo